Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Wealth. I'm Alex Teager and I'm joined pretty much as ever by Ian Wenick. Ian, how are you doing?
Pretty good. You know I run and you know the runner's high is a thing.
Yes.
The scoop high is also a thing and I'm still coming down from that right now.
Okay, so we are recording on Wednesday, the 27th of May. And I mention this because we're recording, I think, literally minutes after having just broken probably our biggest story of the year. And that's what we're going to talk about. And that's what that's the high that you're still on. You're not coming down yet. You're still very much on the way up off the back of this. The adrenaline is pumping. The endorphins are moving.
Yes.
Yeah. I guess if this pod runs too long by the end of it, you might sort of become a hollowed out shell of yourself. But we'll endeavor to make sure that's not the case. Let's get into the story. What's the story? Why are you so excited?
Yes. So we just broke on citywire.com/RA and citywire.com/pro-buyer that Dimensional Fund Advisors, $1 trillion asset manager, a pioneer in factor-based investing, massive manager of active ETFs, that they are pursuing a sale and have retained Moelis, frequently mentioned on this pod, to serve as its financial advisor as looks for a buyer. And they're prioritizing this work. It's interesting. They're prioritizing a sale to a strategic as opposed to deal with a private equity firm or a sovereign wealth fund or another type of institutional investor. So they want to sell to a competitor.
Yeah, absolutely. A huge story. Not every day that an asset manager of this size comes on the market. And normally when it does, it's a very kind of stage managed announcement. Probably they wait until there's an actual offer from someone else before they say anything about this. But not the case here, because that's not really what CityWire's into, not what Ian's into. So we've broken that story and it's fantastic. A few follow-up points here. So this isn't the first time that it's kind of explored a deal.
Yes, that's correct. So other outlets have reported this, including Semaphore and our own. We reported on a little bit a couple years ago, but definitively we can say that a couple years back in 2021 and 2022, that DFA held talks to sell itself to both JP Morgan and then later Goldman Sachs. And it makes sense why both those companies would be interested in buying an asset manager like DFA for two reasons, which is one, those are two big firms, but they're not primarily known for their asset management capabilities. They're more known for investment banking or wealth management. They don't have a massive, massive asset management unit.
I think JP Morgan would push back on that point, to be fair. Yeah. They both, let's not get into it too much. They're sizable. DFA would have differentiated them, obviously.
Yes.
Neither of them specialize in that sort of factor-based investing. Also, DFA's now impressive ETF business would have been appealing. I guess it wasn't quite as big then, but it would have diversified what they have. I think it's, yeah, and you're right. Obviously, for both those businesses, asset management is just one part of what they do. I think, though, to call either of those asset management businesses small would
probably
be unfair.
No, they're big. They're big
unfair.
Businesses. Yeah. But if you're thinking Goldman Sachs, the first thing you're thinking of is probably the investment banking division as opposed to the asset management unit.
Okay, yeah, fair enough.
And then it's also interesting because, again, DFA is not a retail investor household name, or it has not been historically, like a BlackRock or a Vanguard or a State Street, because historically, DFA marketed its mutual funds solely to financial advisors and other intermediaries, which means that whoever buys DFA has instant access to a massive base of advisors who don't just like DFA products. They love them and they're full devotees to DFA's factor-based approach to investing.
Yeah, this is a really good point. I think in the past, I think we could say this. I'll take the swing and deal with the consequences. You know, people have compared it to a cult, I think, which is probably obviously hyperbolic and unfair, but certainly the model has been very successful. You know, the idea was, as I understand it, you had to, as an advisor who wanted to use DFA funds, you had to sort of go to days-long seminars to understand factor investing. Again, I think to DFA's credit, they were very, again, sort of funds that had load fees and things in them. So very sort of fee-based, very sort of investor first. And you had to kind of really adopt that way of working. But as a result of going through that training, and we see this with other firms have done this, private market firms have done this with sort of so-called academies and stuff. But if you invest that time and effort into educating advisors and advisors consequently put the time in too, and they like it, yeah, you've you've got a sort of a very loyal, bought-in group of clients, which is, I would imagine, makes for pretty sticky money. But yeah, DFA changed that. That was their model. It worked really well. They took in lots of money over the years. But they pivoted in 2020 when they launched ETFs. Not, I suppose, because there's anything wrong with the old model, but as we know, ETFs are the vehicle of choice now for financial advisors and ultimately for retail investors. And that will probably be the case for a while going forwards. And they kind of, at a certain point, had to get into that space. And that was a major change for them because clearly by their nature, exchange traded funds are available on exchanges. Anyone can get access to them. And so by DFA offering ETFs, it meant that its strategies were no longer exclusively available through advisors.
Yeah. You know, I think it's interesting. So this isn't a theme that I've reported on significantly for a long time, but it's true is that, you know, we talk about these kind of secular trends in asset and wealth management. And one of them has been this secular trend towards asset managers embracing the ETF wrapper. And it really makes sense for the end investor because ETFs, you have daily liquid, they're super liquid, easy to access, easy to trade. And I think that
Obviously the tax advantage that you get, the way it treats gains versus the way mutual funds does, I think is the sort of the key selling point. But yeah, continue.
Yeah. And so, I mean, just to that point, you know, I think that DFA saw where things were headed and it was willing to kind of sacrifice that element of its identity, which was that we're this gated community, to recognize that this wrapper is where client dollars are going. And look, they have, you know, like you said, they launched their ETFs in 2020. They have about $257 billion in ETF assets.
Out of the trillion. So it's about a quarter of all their assets are now in ETFs, which is impressive if you think they've only been at them for whatever that is now, six years.
And I'm thinking about our friend Eric Balchunas from Bloomberg Intelligence, who calls the ETF space the terror dome. Mm. And we think about how many ETFs get filed and then die out in a couple of months so they can't attract assets. The fact that DFA got to a critical mass of assets that quickly, I think shows kind of how popular their ideas are with retail investors.
Well, okay, there is a little caveat here. So what they did, and I don't have these numbers to hand, but they converted a lot of existing mutual funds into ETFs. I think, again, to paraphrase or quote Eric Balchunas, he used to quote, bring your own assets, like bring your own booze, kind of. Is that a phrase in America? Bring your own bottle?
BYOB, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Bring your own assets, which was, you know, you can very quickly achieve scale in the ETF space if you are converting a lump of existing assets. And look, I don't have the numbers to hand, so I don't want to speak out of school on this, but I know certainly they created a pretty solid base by converting some pretty chunky existing mutual funds into the ETF format. That's not to say those ETFs haven't gone on to get organic flows since, or that that's the only reason they've got that money, but that was definitely a factor. I would say though as well, to be fair to them, they went from kind of zero to 60 pretty quickly on ETFs. So they went from not having any to obviously making these big conversions. Conversions, when they were sort of doing them back in 2020, were kind of, that was a new thing. That was a kind of vanguard, not vanguard the company, vanguard is in the bleeding edge of things, to do, to convert funds into ETFs was a bit of a flex. And they did that. They embraced that kind of new world. And they've also been at the forefront of the share class application. So this is the idea, actually, in this case, like the company Vanguard, whereby you can offer ETFs as a share class of a mutual fund, which was something that only Vanguard could do for a long time. It had a patent on that mechanism, and that's changed. And we saw a flood of, I think I've lost track of the numbers now, 70, 80, 90 plus firms have applied for this. And DFA was at the front of that line. And I think they've got it over the line. They've got approval for it. Whether they've actually now launched those share classes of mutual funds, I'm not sure. But so they've actually been, they sort of went from being kind of, let's say, a little bit behind in the race for ETFs to actually being pretty innovative. So credit to them. And we've probably talked too much about ETFs. Let's get back to the firm.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking, you know, moving into your favorite, one of your favorite phrases, rank speculation.
Yeah.
You know, maybe we should talk a little about who could be a potential buyer of a firm like this. Because I think that from a macro level, these asset management businesses face the same problem that these large wealth managers do. Like, we wrote about this and talked about this when Edelman Financial Engines tried to sell itself and couldn't find a buyer. The universe of strategics that can cut a check big enough to buy a company of this size is very, very, very small. And, you know, the names that stand out to me, again, I'll put these out to you. This is not based on reporting. This is just thinking out loud. I mean, would BlackRock or Vanguard make sense? I mean, obviously, they're the biggest by assets, State Street.
So, okay, I'm going to take one step back to and then attempt to dodge the question, which I think is the bravest thing any man can ever do. So it's an interesting time, isn't it, to be on the market. It does feel like a more buoyant time in asset management, M&A. We've seen quite a lot of deals in the last sort of 6 months that maybe the volume's a bit higher than it has been. So Janus Henderson going private with Nelson Peltz's Trian. We saw Nuveen is agreed to buy Schroders. We saw Goldman, again, another great Ian Wenick scoop, Goldman Sachs buying innovator ETFs. So there's been a lot of activity, maybe more activity than we've seen for a while in that space. Who would buy Dimensional? I mean, obviously the honest answer is I don't know. None of the names you just said stand out to me as firms that would. They don't need the scale. They're obviously they're kind of, at least two of them are the biggest in the world already. They're also already huge in this sort of ETF and in the kind of beta space. You know, obviously Vanguard, a pioneer of index investing, full stop. iShares, you know, a lot of it's vanilla indexing too. It also does, you know, it will have its own existing suite of fact. I mean, iShares does everything, doesn't it? So it will have existing factor ETFs as well. It has thematics, and frankly, it doesn't need the scale. It has a very loyal advisor base, as does Vanguard. So I don't really see either of those being a particular fit. I don't say Street again. I think it kind of fits broadly into the same realm. I think maybe, you know, not to lean too heavily on where we were before, but perhaps it is more of a, you know, we know that some of those bigger banks were looking to diversify and add asset management skill sets. So maybe you do go back to a JPM or a Goldman. Although Citi doesn't have an asset management division. And I guess, would you start one from scratch? I don't think you would.
You can buy it or build it.
Yeah. I don't know. It's actually much harder to try and answer questions, isn't it? This is why I like being a journalist, just ask questions. But I would say none of those scream out to me as a particular fit. But what do I know?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that the equity check that's going to need to get cut for DFA is going to be well into the billions of dollars. I mean, we talk about the Nuveen Schroders transaction. I mean, look, obviously those have different elements of the business, but you know, that was a $13.4 billion deal. Goldman paid, I think, $2 billion for Innovator. And, you know, Innovator's a pretty big firm in its own right, but it's a fraction of the size of what DFA is.
Yeah, and that did seem like a pretty good valuation for Innovator, which obviously a relatively younger firm and obviously much smaller in scope than something like DFA. I mean, look, yeah, you say that, but it'll be a transformational deal for whoever acquires it. You know, you're acquiring a $1 trillion firm. If, let's say, you're already a $1 trillion firm yourself, this is sharp math, puts you at $2 trillion. It puts you probably just outside the top 10, top 12. If you're bigger than that already, you know, suddenly you're into the $3 trillion sort of space and you're, you know, a top 7-8 player globally. I think these deals can also surprise you. You know, I don't think anyone would have had on their bingo card at the start of the year that Nuveen from Chicago would be buying sort of European blue-blooded Royal Asset Manager Schroders, but that happened. So you just don't know. And again, once you see those deals take place, you can sort of post-fact see some logic there. You go, oh, well, that makes sense. Nuveen has a limited global presence outside of the US. Schroders, again, less successful in the US. Actually, that's a good fit. But you wouldn't have necessarily put two and two together before. So this is me making excuses for not having a good answer as to who might do the deal, I suppose.
Well, I look forward to tracking this in the months to come.
Yeah.
Something tells you we're not done writing about it.
I think that's fair. Is it? Yeah, as covered, it's a good time to maybe be looking to do deals in the asset management market. We also know from your previous reporting and your reporting in this that, you know, as I say, they explored a sale in the past. So it makes sense that sort of, 4 or 5 years later, you come back to market. The general sort of perceived wisdom is you can't go to market sort of 1 year later. You have to kind of wait those things out a little bit. We also know that the ownership model of the firm and maybe the age of those owners would sort of suggest that now wouldn't be the worst time to sell, if that's right.
Yeah, no, that's 100% true. I mean, you know what? It's kind of like, because again, a massive chunk of DFA is still owned by founder and chairman David Booth. Again, a lot of RAs have come to market because they need a succession plan. This is similar to that on a massive scale.
On a massive scale. Yeah, interesting. And to your point, you know, we know a lot of RAAs are big users. It kind of fits that mentality that, you know, if we think of the RAA movement, one part of it back in the day was very much about being fee-based, being fiduciary, putting your clients first. And DFA's approach to no-load fees and stuff kind of fits with that. And so, yeah, I think it'll be very big for our RAA readers, many of whom will be, you know, massive clients of yes. DFA.
Yes.
Excellent. Do we have any more on that? I mean, is your heart still pounding? Do you have more to say?
It's slowing down a little bit. We're down to like a baseline level. The cortisol levels are dropping rapidly.
Excellent. What do you do at the end of a run to kind of get out of your system?
Well, the thing is that usually when I'm going on a run, I'm listening to the Padres game. And when they're losing, it usually just kind of works the stress up because I'm getting angrier as I run.
Okay. Well, maybe later you can. Are the Padres playing today?
Yes, but okay. That game will have ended long before this pod airs.
Yeah, fair enough. All right. We will move on. Well, look, fascinating story. As ever, I think we say this too often, but watch this space, Ian, to what you just said. I think, look, this is probably not the last time we're going to be writing about that. We'll be keenly reporting this out and we'll see what, if anything, happens. I mean, I guess we should caveat this with, you know, not all processes end in a sale. The last time they did this, it didn't. There may not be many firms willing to cut a check. We don't know what markets are going to do the rest of the year. And these things can take a long time as well. If it's early stages, we may not see anything for quite a while. Good. Okay. Well, with those caveats out of the way, let's move on to another big piece of news that we published this last week, and that is our annual RAA pay report. So our colleague Andrew Forsh should really take a lot of the credit for this, building the survey, chasing up scores of advisors to fill it out, and then crunching all the data at the end of it, along with some other colleagues at the company too, we should note. Andrew sadly is not well today, so Ian, you're going to valiantly fill in and tell us the highlights from this year's pay report.
Yeah, so again, the pay report is a massive undertaking. If you're a subscriber to citywire.com/RAA's email newsletter, you're probably prompted to participate at some point during January and February. And so we had 129 respondents in total. About 42% of those were advisors. We had a lot of CEOs, other support staffers. And what's fascinating is that, one, there's actually a slight decline in terms of total comp year over year. So client-facing advisors now bring home an average of $407,963. That's a mixture of cash plus your base salary, your cash bonus, your equity bonus.
So the average annual salary there was about $240,000.
Yes, that's correct.
Was the sort of the basic.
Yes. And then it's a slight decline relative to 25, which was about 442,000 in total comp. But that's probably a function of just the data set that we have.
Yeah, who filled it in? We know it's not the same people doing it every time. The total number of people might change too. Now, that was based on client-facing advisors who, for the most part in our survey, worked at RAAs. I think of our survey, yes. 80% of people worked at RAAs, and 40% of the people who filled it in were client-facing FAs. We should say, and I don't want to kind of start with too many caveats and qualifiers, but this survey probably skews high.
Yes, that's definitely true. We even have the numbers of my experience. We have a couple people, like I'm looking at our scatter plot right now. You see a lot clustered in the 15 years of experience, 25, 30, 35. We even have some people that have north of 40 years of professional experience. And so that naturally skews higher as you get older.
We also skew, again, I mean, some of this is normal, but we skew in terms of location to some of the coastal areas as well, yes. Don't we? Where, you know, cost of living is going to be higher. Therefore, salaries are commensurately higher, et cetera, too. So again, yes. As a sort of national average, this probably, you know, if you wanted a true baseline national for the whole nation, this probably isn't it.
No, but it's not perfect.
But it is a reflection on what the readers of Citywire RAA are making. Yeah.
And what I found fascinating is that, you know, at the high end and the low end, there's a massive, massive gap. So for example, and Andrew to his credit found two great individual examples. On the low end, we found, and that this is the type of advisor that you'd find all over the country. And that's a 22-year-old entry-level advisor at a firm with $50 to $100 million in assets. And they said they made $60,000 with a $10,000 cash bonus. Then on the other end, an advisor, 38 years old, with 16 years of experience and their own personal book of business, north of $300 million, she reported a salary of $300K, a million-dollar cash bonus.
That's really interesting. I thought those examples were fascinating. And I think the other thing to say as well is obviously just the size of firm that we've got involved. So you mentioned there the person who's earning the less there, obviously much younger, but also at a much smaller firm. And again, perhaps one of the reasons why our data set skews higher is that generally, and this is not, you know, universally true, but Citywire RAA is very well read by some of the larger RAA practices out there, and they will have more money and therefore, you know, there'll be
more capital to disperse to employees.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The bottom line is that there's a lot more RAAs that employ people like that 22-year-old advisor that are either effectively sole proprietorships or just above a lifestyle practice. You know, that's the massive base of the pyramid of firms in this of this industry.
Well, that brings us on to something as well, which is talking about sort of the equity component of things. So this is a, you know, I feel this is a topic that's bubbled under forever in the RAA space, but it's really getting a lot of airtime this year, which is this whole issue of, you know, who actually has equity in the company. And again, the kind of classic dynamic is actually it's these sort of slightly older founders who've held on to it all and have now either sold it or are thinking of selling it. And that sort of next generation coming through doesn't have the level of equity that they perhaps would have liked or perhaps might have got had they been born 20 years earlier or something. What did our survey say in terms of how much equity people have or how much their remuneration is paid in company stock?
Yeah, so there's a couple of points we can hit on here. I think the first is that, and this doesn't shock me because this is the model that we see with CEOs of public companies, but we had about 11 or 12 CEOs fill out our survey. And for them, 61% of their total comp came in the form of cash and equity bonuses. And typically, those cash bonuses are tied to performance. We see this with public company CEOs all the time. They have a relatively low base salary. The bulk of their compensation comes from cash bonuses and equity comp. The other thing that I found fascinating, and again, this is not a shock. This is kind of like a fork found in kitchen thing. But the compensation diversion for employees that had equity or a partner of the firm versus just a standard W-2 employee, I found fascinating. So, for example, this is from our data I got in front of me. If you were both a W-2 employee and a partner of the RAA that they worked at, the respondents who answered yes to both those check questions had an average base salary of north of $300,000. If they were just a W-2 employee without any equity, that average total, that average base salary dropped to $185,000. And there's an even bigger diversion in terms of non-guaranteed cash comp. For the W-2 employee without equity, it was about $94,000. For a W-2 employee who has partner status, $240,000.
Wow. Okay. That's a really big difference.
That cash bonus, like that's equivalent to like the starting salary at a big law and a big law job.
Yeah, which again,
that's real money.
Yeah, I don't want to kind of play down these findings, but as I say, I do think they probably skewed to the larger end, and there's lots of people who aren't getting anywhere near that. But that reflects the readership base and sort of size and scope of many of the firms that are sort of frequent loyal readers of Citywire RAA. Let's talk a little bit about PE backing as well. So that's obviously something that we talk about a lot on the podcast, something we write about a lot, and as touched on a moment ago, a big way in which ownership structures within the RAA space are changing. We all know that if a PE firm takes a stake in your RAA, for those selling, that's a massive payday. For those who stay on and are just owned by a PE firm or have minority backing from a PE firm, does that suddenly mean the floodgates are open and everyone's really well paid?
No, it was kind of a reverse delta, actually. So again, pulling the chart in front of me, the total average comp for employees of firms that were manager employee owned, and this is all in factoring cash bonus, was just short of $500,000. For companies that are majority owned by a private equity sponsor, that total comp dropped a little bit below $400,000. And for firms that are minority backed, I was shocked by this. It's just over $300,000 all in. So there's a massive, there is a delta. It's not gargantuan, but there is a delta between being employee-owned versus sponsor-backed.
Yeah, and it's also interesting because, okay, again, we should specify here, no one's going hungry here. if you're still your average is over 300k, things are kind of pretty good. But with that said, yeah, interesting that manager employee owned kind of pays out the most. Again, might that be a reflection of the fact that a lot of the people that filled that survey out and fell into that category might be the owners of their own businesses, so likely to be some of the higher earners there. So again, it's sort of based a little bit on the sample, but I thought that was fascinating that still, if you were at a kind of owner-led firm, still you actually might be doing better than one that had sold some of its.
Well, you know, it makes sense. Again, if you're at as we've talked about before, these businesses generate insane amounts of free cash flow. And if you're working at a business that is, again, bigger than a lifestyle practice, but not massive, that's still generating a lot of cash. And with fewer people in the business, that's more cash to disperse.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, last question, because there's loads of other stuff we could cover in here. We could talk more about the gender gap, which that will be news to no one, is obviously not great. We could talk about location. We could talk about sort of whether sort of being in the business development role is sort of crucial to earning more money. But I don't want to go through it sort of chart by chart. What I would like to do, though, is end on whether people are happy or not, whether there is a correlation between how much people get paid and whether they're satisfied with their pay.
Well, you know, there were very few people that said that they were overpaid. That's a shock.
Oh, so we asked people, are you overpaid, appropriately compensated, or underpaid? And no one said they're overpaid.
No.
Okay. But more people did say they were appropriately compensated than underpaid. But those that said they were appropriately compensated were paid a lot more.
Yeah, north of $500,000 all in.
And they were all like, yeah, that's about right, actually. Yeah, that's what I should get paid. And people who were paid as shockingly little as about 200 grand of base salary were not necessarily happy about that.
No. Well, actually, there's really not that much diversion between the base salaries, people who think they're appropriately paid versus underpaid. Appropriately compensated said 240K base. Underpaid said 224,600 base.
But the kicker came in the...
It's the bonuses.
Yeah.
It's the bonuses. That's the massive diversion. So for people that said they're appropriately paid, they reported a cash bonus of $210,000 a year. For people that said they're underpaid, that cash bonus shrank to $78,000.
Yeah.
So we're talking about, you know, again, a little less than a 3x difference.
Really interesting. Anything else that left out at you, Ian, before we move on from the pay report?
I think the fact that, not to get too deep into the gender pay gap stuff.
No, go for it. I mean, it's a really interesting and important topic.
I mean, there is just a massive disparity in response. We had 100 men respond and 27 women respond and 2 people that were non-binary respond. You know, it just shows the gap in overall employment. And also, if you look at the women in the survey, they reported equity non-cash compensation of just $5,000 per year, whereas men reported about $61,500 of non-cash sort of equity comp per year. And that's a massive gap in terms of also shows how few women actually own these businesses.
Well, yeah, this is it, isn't it? Because again, if you look at it by role and then by gender, you'll see that CEOs, we had a lot more male CEOs obviously responding than female CEOs. And yeah, again, that kind of speaks to who sort of owns these businesses and things. I think it's broadly reflective of the wider industry, isn't it? It's sort of holding a mirror up to that, and it probably breaks down along those sort of representation lines. But yeah, it's a big gap in terms of the overall numbers, in terms of the equity ownership as well. I think that's probably consistent with previous years, but certainly not any sort of meaningful progress there in terms of that gap closing, or it didn't feel like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Excellent. Well, if you're interested in the pay report, I think we've said this enough times, but check out citywire.com/RAA to read it all in detail and see some of the great charts we've put together there. Also, if you've already read that but you're hungry for more, good news is on the way. We're going to be doing more with this. We actually collected more data than we put in that initial report. So in the coming days and weeks, we're going to have a couple of follow-up pieces. I think the next one's going to look at sort of pay and equity compensation and how that differs between firms of different sizes. Again, all kind of focused on the RAA space. I think some of our data did capture some wires and OSJs and broker dealers, but the focus of those next reports is very much going to be kind of like how small, mid-sized boutique and large mega RAAs kind of compensate, particularly on the equity side of things. So that'll be great. Keep an eye out for that. Ian, I think we've discussed, you know, your running highs, your story highs. What's next? How are you going to top this this DFA story for the rest of the week?
You're just going to keep checking your email.
Okay, well, very good. All right. We're off to the Mets tonight, so that's exciting for us. By the time this comes out, we'll know how much they lost by, and you can see that for yourselves. I think we'll leave it there. Ian, thank you very much indeed. Listener, thank you very much indeed, and we will be back again very soon for another episode of This Week in Wealth.